Welcome to Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership, the podcast that provides you with the insights and strategies to excel on your nonprofit leadership journey. I'm your host, Patton McDowell, and delighted to have you join me for another strategic leadership conversation. Now, this episode is sponsored by PMA's Mastermind Leadership Development Program, now accepting applications for the 2024 summer and fall cohorts. Now, if you're ready to enhance your leadership skills and connect with our national community of nonprofit leaders, now's the time. Go to the Mastermind page at pmanonprofit.com to learn more and apply today. That's pmanonprofit.com/mastermind. Well, I've got another fantastic conversation to share with you because episode number 254 welcomes Leif Cox, the founder of Wildlife Conservation International. He's based in Perth, Australia, and shares wonderful expertise on building a global nonprofit, as he has done, and he emphasizes the importance of effective leadership, fundraising dynamics, and storytelling to drive impactful change on a global scale. But whether you're leading a small grassroots organization or you're leading a large multinational nonprofit, Leif's insights are going to provide you with some valuable strategies and takeaways to enhance your leadership skills and drive more meaningful impact. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Leif Cox. Leif, thank you for joining me on the path.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I'm excited about this conversation, Leif. You truly represent global leadership in the not-for-profit sector. It's remarkable what you've done, what you've accomplished, and I know our listeners are going to benefit from the wisdom, maybe the mistakes you've made that you learned from and have gotten better. And clearly you're passionate about conservation in many different respects. So what, almost, was it 25 years ago or more when you first started some of this work? Has it surprised you how things have grown over the years?
Yeah, it's probably been a lot more than that. It's probably been 35 years.
Wow.
But it's only since 1998 we had, you know, the start of the orangutan project and various sister projects. But the work started well before then as sort of a lifelong mission to achieve something meaningful for orangutans, a habitat and the planet.
Did you grow up in a family that conservation was kind of top of mind, or what literally was the inspiration that led to the work that you did as an adult?
No, I mean, often people want to highlight something like that. But I grew up in an artistic family. So my sister's an actress, my father's an artist. And I was brought up in Hong Kong, one of the big major metropolises of the world, right. not far from a natural environment. But I always had an affinity for animals and nature. And so I think it was inherent in me rather than a product of the environment I grew up in.
All right. Well, let's talk about the origin story of the conservation work. What motivated you to get involved and then ultimately to start an organization? I mean, did you look around and feel like, hey, no one else is doing what needs to be done?
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, because if we really want to do good in the world, we see a problem and we say that problem needs to be solved. And then we want to work out what is the best way of solving that problem. And perhaps creating your own organization isn't the best way to solve that problem. There may be others in the field and others with, you know, that you can support, or your skill set is totally mismatched to support that particular cause. So it's really defining it over and making sure that you can make meaningful change with your efforts. So I think that's a very good part of it. And of course, my origin story is working with orangutans, discovering that they're self-aware persons and didn't belong in captivity, can only thrive and survive in the long term in their own cultures, in their own environment. And of course, very quickly, after spending a lot of time in Indonesia, with orangutans, rescuing them, they're discovering that they've been driven to extinction by the destruction of their rainforest homes. So that kind of led me on my mission to say, well, this is a problem that I wish to solve. There's gaps in here that no one's attending to that need to be addressed. And lastly, I had the skill set. You know, I had, you know, my research and my academic qualifications was in primates and orangutans. And so I had the skill set to be able to apply to make that meaningful change I was after.
You were studying, obviously, the world that in which you now occupy your organization. So in the mid-90s, again, I'm imagining a listener who has a cause they're passionate about listening somewhere around the world. So for you, you saw the problem of their environments being destroyed. Did you look around at first and say, all right, somebody else must be focused on this and realize nobody else is, therefore I should start an organization?
No, exactly. And that's all the first step I recommend is, you know, the last thing we need is another organization trying to solve the same problem and competing against the guy down the road saying, I'm better than him. So let's, you know, that's just not how we solve problems in the world. And so the first course should always be if there's, you know, people and organizations doing what you want to make happen in the world, support them, you know, combine and work with them before thinking about starting your own organization.
For someone who's thinking about this kind of work, again, what exactly, and for someone, of course, I want to introduce them to the Orangutan Project, talk about what it is. And I know you have proliferated some of your conservation work into multiple organizations, but for a listener who doesn't know what you do exactly, Leif, explain the work you're doing.
Yeah. Well, our main mission is to save the orangutans and the habitat. So one day all orangutans will live in viable populations in secure habitat. But it was always meant to be that orangutans were the umbrella species, that all other biodiversity, other megafauna communities and one of the most cost-effective measures to mitigate climate change were all going to come underneath it. However, we discovered that there were three species falling outside of the umbrella. Elephants and people killing each other, trying to survive in the remaining forest. Tigers were being poached by criminal syndicates. And indigenous communities were losing their land and livelihoods due to their land rights not being recognized. And so we started the International Tiger Project, Elephant Project, and Forest for People to bring all living beings under our umbrella of concern and love. Because I'm a firm believer we can only solve problems in the world through win-win solutions. If we have any losers in the equation, you know, it's the bit of the jigsaw puzzle which, if missing, will cause everything to collapse. So conservation or any charity welfare has to be something that benefits all. Otherwise, it's a house of cards that will eventually fall down. But drilling down a little bit more specifically, our strategic goal is to save 8 ecosystems, the right type, shape, and size of rainforest. So the rainforest itself can be sustainable because rainforest creates its own humidity, rainfall, and needs to a certain size and shape to hold biodiversity and survive in itself. And then obviously be large enough to contain the megafauna in sustainable populations, which we want to secure for the long-term future. So that gives you kind of a general overview of our mission and strategy.
It's remarkable. But I'm struck too, Leif, by the global scope, multiple, you know, species and obviously different countries, different dynamics, different environments. So did you start in a more narrow focus? No, did you start, all right, let's start with this species in this area of the world, or right off the bat, you realize this was a global issue and you're going to try to tackle it that way?
Mm-hmm. As we grow, we kept on adding ecosystems into our portfolio on the ground. So, you know, and so they kept on adding on as we had more funds and more resources to apply to more ecosystems. That's got us to 8 ecosystems, right, which we have concerns with now and to survive. And the ambition was always to get to 8 at least, is because orangutans, there's actually 3 species of orangutans. And the Borneo orangutan has at least 3 subspecies.
Wow.
So it's not good enough to just save one population of orangutans, think you're going to save orangutans. And there's also these feedback loops, with, for example, with climate change, where orangutans exist in the largest numbers in coastal peat swamps. Those peat swamps may be inundated by sea level rise and destroy those rainforests. And so putting all your eggs in one basket and just concentrating on one ecosystem is also not a good strategy when you're dealing with conservation. So that's one side of things. The other side of things is to achieve that financial capacity to work in the ecosystems, we had to start chapters in the US, Canada, New Zealand, the European Union, et cetera, to have these diverse charities collecting money, offering tax deductibility as a network of charity and fundraising to move in. So both the conservation network on the ground and the charity network globally works together to support the ecosystem to affect the changes we're after.
Is the invitation to invest charitably, is it largely just to purchase land? Is that ultimately what you're having to do to acquire and thus preserve some of these ecosystems around the world?
Yeah, the main game is to conserve these whole ecosystems, leasing land, purchasing land, protecting land, restoring land, piecing together these viable ecosystems. But also, as orangutans are critically endangered, every individual orangutan is important for the survival of its own species. So welfare and conservation combined, because when we're re-establishing these extinct or degraded populations of orangutans, the rescue, rehabilitation, release of the individuals, not only a welfare outcome, but a conservation outcome. Now, as far as with focusing on the donor, it tends to be donors naturally want to make a meaningful change, but that meaningful change is related to their capacity to give. So major donors have the ability to save vast ecosystems, which is, you know, land purchase, leasing, you were talking about in the millions. Whereas a small donor is probably more likely to give to, for example, rescuing, rebuilding an orangutan, because it's a more significant contribution they're making to that cause. And so it's a mixture. It really depends on which level of donor, what piece of the puzzle that they tend to want to give to.
Yeah, and you do very well in appealing. You identify the type of donor, don't you? And you can see where they might invest and thus give them opportunity. And you can demonstrate the power of that charitable gift, can't you, in terms of land or in terms of preserving the species themselves.
Exactly. But one of the important things about fundraising, it's an emotional we give because it makes us feel good and empowers us to make that meaningful change. But thinking about things too much and giving too much choice actually reduces people's desire to give. It generates the other part of the brain. So you can't educate someone to give. So the more you talk to them...
you can't talk too much about it, right? Yeah.
No, exactly. So... what you want to do is give them the problem and the solution and allow them to move to doing that. The difference is with the major gifts, the major donors, I have a personal relationship with them, you know, and I take them on that journey of education to understanding the whole ecosystem and how it's all structured and how large donations can make their impact. But you have to take them on that journey. Because I think becoming too intellectual without that ability to support someone's entire journey actually turns people off conservation. This is why there's formula. For example, if you talk about climate change, you're not going to get any money. Although
interesting,
everyone would say it's the most important issue of our time, existential threat, you can't raise money from climate change. As soon as you talk about climate change, everyone switches off. Saving a baby orangutan, yes, you know, everyone is, you know, more people switched on and wanted to make that meaningful change. And so there's a bit of a dichotomy there.
Right.
You know, we're after strategic, long-term, significant change, but we have to connect with people on an emotive level and level of impact, which is consummate to their capacity to give.
I find that fascinating because you yourself are a scientist, an academic. So you know the science, but you have also, I guess, learned that the game of philanthropy requires the storytelling and the emotional appeal. And that's what you and your organization have done very well.
Exactly. But it's also science, because there's a science to psychology, how we as humans, you know, relate to the world and you know, and what motivates us. And particularly to give. And so it's like anything, it's understanding the science, whether it's the science of fundraising and connecting with people, or the science of conservation outcomes. And of course, many organizations do one really well,
right,
and think that you speak intellectually and you talk about science and then turn everybody off. Right. Or you're very good at communicating and getting passion, but you're not very good at affecting meaningful change. But it's understanding both sciences, the science of charity and the science of, in this case, conservation.
You're a Renaissance man. You have to be, don't you, of multiple disciplines in terms of academics and science. And all right, but I got to ask you again, you're based in Australia. How did you expand? You know, you talk about from, it sounds like, the structure of your charitable efforts. Of course, you reeled off the countries all over the world. How do you find people? How do you establish these charitable outposts, I guess, that ultimately help you raise money?
I have this, about six times a year, I take people in the rainforest. And they make a donation to the organization, and they pay it away. And I take people in the rainforest to see the project, see the heroes on the ground making that meaningful change. And many of them are, well, they're well-educated professionals. Actually, the number one profession on my trips are doctors. There's always at least one doctor on my trip.
Right,
Or medical specialists and that sort of stuff. But also lawyers and accountants, successful businessmen. These are sort of the people, you know, that come on my trips. And so many of them are what's called my tour alumni, then go on to become directors of the charities. So for example, in America, Scott and Lauren are two US-based directors for a US charity. Scott is a New York lawyer, and Lauren is a curator at one of the museums in New York. And so they have all these skills already, and they're also, they've gone to the field and being and engage. In fact, actually, Scott and Lauren's been on two Echo tours. A lot of them come back and again and again, and so they're engaged, and because they've seen it in reality themselves, they have the confidence that their work is really going to make the meaningful impact in the world that they're seeking to have.
That's fantastic, and it makes sense. So you give them the experience, the up close view of the world in which you live and are trying to preserve, and they come back as pretty gifted ambassadors, I would think, right, to serve in terms of helping bring others to the cause.
Exactly. And the good thing is because it's, as we kind of touched on, it's a huge variety of ecosystems, both in conservation and charities. And so normally everyone has a skill that they can contribute. Whether it's managing people, it's legal, it's accounting, it's business, etc. And so you provide the opportunity for not only people to make that meaningful change, but use the skills that they already have and apply those to make the meaningful change that we're after.
Talk about your governance as an NGO, a nonprofit. Do some of these ambassadors serve on your board of directors? Do you have a governing board, an advisory board? How do you structure that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in the way charities work, to get tax deductibility in each country or let's say the European Union, you have to have a legal entity there. And that legal entity has its own laws and bylaws and has its own stipulations, how many have to be local and local directors, etc. So it's about managing this whole ecosystem of directors and boards with different rules and regulations in different countries. And so, and as I said, we talked about how they've come on board. But I also sit on the board and of all these charities around the world. But then every 6 weeks, they come on the advisory board, and then the international organization as such meets together. And so we have that communication with all the different chapters around the world.
So how many boards are you managing? How many does that end up now?
One, two, five.
Well, you know, that's going to lead to my next question is, how do you stay organized, Leif? You've been prolific in your writing and research. You're obviously traveling a lot. You're managing five boards. And how big is your staff, by the way? How many employees do you have within the organization?
Within the fundraising side, we probably have about 10, and about half of those are part-time. We keep the cost really low. Everyone works at home on their own computer.
Got it.
So we have a virtual office. We don't have any bricks and mortars. That keeps that very low. And then we have all the volunteer boards and directors around. But in the field, you know, we've got my field managers, which you direct, and then we've got hundreds of people on the ground that we fund and support.
That's remarkable.
It's quite a substantial kind of eclectic
operation.
Mix of people and organizations
Well, again, what my question is. I hear this all the time. Nonprofit leaders, juggling so many things, wearing so many hats. So I wonder how do you personally stay organized? Are you a to-do list guy, or is it calendaring that keeps you straight? How do you manage all of these activities you have to keep up with?
I mean, I've got my inbox in, of emails and things to do. I have a set of tasks. I have the calendar. But most importantly, and then I have my meetings, my different group, my field managers.
That's how you keep it organized.
Exactly. But of course, the most important thing is to employ people and manage them well in that sense. And managing them well often means is managing them as little as possible. I'd say if you're managing somebody too much, you probably just got the wrong person.
I guess you do a very good job explaining the role you hire them for, and then you let them go. I mean, you obviously at that point feel like they're competent to do the job.
Yeah, no, it's like, yeah, exactly. And most of the people, for example, the directors, they've volunteered for 15 years. I've known them, for years. It's not like they're strangers. And, my elephant field manager, I was supporting his master's and supporting his work in his first conservation project. And now he works for me and helps manage all my elephant projects. My orangutan field manager, I supported, or the first person to support his local NGO in Indonesia, 20 years ago. And been working with him for 20 years until then he's come on board as my field manager to manage all the projects. So it's not like, it's very rarely in the conservation field, I'm actually, having an unknown person that I'm going through a selection process. These are people that I work with and trust with for, over a decade at least, and so there's no risk. And, we're already working together and we're already achieving together meaningful outcomes. And then at certain stage, that just gets formalized under our umbrella.
That strikes me as a takeaway, right? That You have a wonderful volunteer program, and a lot of these folks have proven themselves, right, as volunteers. Clearly, they're committed to the cause because they weren't getting paid to do it. And so I guess that helps validate the kind of people, because you told me before, and I was going to ask you again, all right, you've had people that have stayed with you literally for decades. And so is that what you would attribute to their longevity, is that you've given them kind of an environment to do the things they love?
Exactly. I mean, I predominantly hire people because they're values, you know. So
talk about that. Yeah.
And so that they're with me and they're working alongside me because of their values. And it's natural that after some time they think, well, hold it, if I have the same values as this guy called Leif, and he can support me to achieve the meaningful outcomes that I want, you know, and empower me to make that meaningful change, I'm better off sitting with him, you know, to achieve those aims. And so, and that's what happens. So, you know, the idea is, you know, people not going, I'm working, you know, they're working for the values that they want to do and achieve, you know, and they just become part of that ecosystem, you know, that we're all working together to achieve that aim.
Makes good sense. And you're right. They don't feel like they're part of some hierarchy of structure. They're actually doing the work they want to do, and you've given them the latitude to do that. And I wonder, again, given the different geographic and political environments of each of your ecosystems, do you get into government relations work, or are you having to get into advocacy because of, I guess, the implications of some of these governments as it relates to their natural areas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's extremely difficult, especially in some places, becoming more xenophobic,
right,
more authoritarian, you know, free press has been, well, so there, so it's becoming increasingly complex in environment. But then often all this comes down to people, because within the government and these sorts of things, there's always wonderful people who are looking for opportunities to do some good and make some meaningful change. And so it's about relationships. Yeah, it's about, yeah, you know, that again that allows us to make that meaningful change. And yes, as you mentioned, the government is can't be excluded from any process. You know, they need to be a major stakeholder and investor in what we're trying to achieve.
Well, you talked about the 8 ecosystems was an early vision for you and the organization. So you're making great progress. As you look to the next 5 and even 10 years, is it expansion of those 8 ecosystems where you are now, or what's next as you look forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's holding us back is, you know, the all one step holding us back. What holding us back is not enough money to move to where we want to. So yes, we would expand the number of ecosystems, and for example, with elephants, we're already starting to do a little bit of work in Sri Lanka, where there's some significant benefits there that we could do to elephants and Lao, as 2 examples. But it's just really a matter of, you know, trying to the most difficult thing is to raise the money, and then we normally have the skills and the people. Yeah, and the strategy to affect that once the money comes in.
Would you take on other species, or you feel like you've identified the core species around which you build, or how do you approach that?
Mm-hmm. We certainly, you know, if we suddenly had a lot of money, we would take on a larger role. But importantly, and we do this with projects and ecosystems, you don't, and this is my kind of criticism of often grant giving bodies. They give grants here, the next grant there, and oh, this is interesting, give the grant there. And behind all these successful grants are projects and ecosystems which are collapsing. Because they just go on to the next one, you know, the next interesting thing and the next trend. And then that's just really not a way to achieve meaningful outcomes. So once we have a partnership with an organization,
yep,
or we involve with the ecosystem, we never leave. We're there for the long haul, and we will keep staying there and working there till the outcome's achieved. And so if we add another species or another location into that, it only can happen once, you know, we have enough resources to maintain the ecosystems and projects and people that we're already supporting.
Well, you mentioned partnerships, and clearly you're really good at it. What is your approach to other organizations in the conservation space? Is there a natural network around the globe of organizations like that, or are you looking for partnerships and projects to do together? How does that work for you?
Mm-hmm. Folks, yeah. So let's say we identify this is a key ecosystem in our strategy to secure. And then we go, well, what is there any organizations working in there and doing the work that we'd probably do if they weren't doing it? And therefore, then we support them. Is there organizations in our ecosystem that could actually do some of this work better than us, rather than us doing it directly? And we go and support them. And so it's about, it's never about the organization. It's about achieving the outcome.
Yes.
And what other organizations and people, you know, can we support to achieve the outcome most cost effectively? And so we're kind of like the filler. You know, if it's money, we put it in. If it's skills and training, we put it in. If it's starting a new project, we'll also do that. But we only fill in the gaps that is necessary. That makes it very efficient. But also, you not end up competing. You know, the classic example of, you know, someone starts a project and, you know, then competes and wants to destroy the other project because they're taking the name, fame, money, reputation. And, you know, and all it does is just makes things worse, you know. And we have to go beyond the selfish needs of the individual and also the selfish needs of the organization. Some people take up what they believe to be a higher ideal is to support the organization. No, and I will say to my staff, the organization is meaningless. It has no value. It's only an instrument to effect a meaningful change. So never think about the organization competing against other organizations. That's not the purpose of the organization at all. It's a vehicle to achieve meaningful change. And if a meaningful change doesn't require that organization anymore, get rid of it. It's only a tool. It's not a means to an end.
It's a wonderful emphasis you have on it's the outcome that matters, right? Not the organization that gets credit for it or competes for it, right?
Exactly, because, and this is one of the key things is, you know, you can't reform the world unless you reform yourself. And so when we're talking about not-for-profit leadership, most of the problem I see with not-for-profit leaderships is they're trying to reform the world without reforming themselves. So they have a sense of hollowness inside them, which they're trying to fill with name, fame, money, and power. And they use their organization as a proxy to achieve that name, fame, money, and power, you know, and reputation. And what it does is it destroys the outcome, you know, and because they're competing against others, and, you know, and that subconsciously becomes what they're really seeking to achieve. And so that's why you can't reform the world unless you reform yourself. So, you know, you got to just selflessly work, you know, beyond that. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with name, fame, power, money, and reputation.
Right.
If you have no value for it, because you can use those to raise money and support for your cause. But if you need that for the support of your sense of self-worth, and therefore you start competing against others. And this is one of the funny things I often say is, if you go to a room of conservationists and you really want to get them angry, don't mention the people destroying the planet. They seem to be fairly mild response to that. But the guy down the road who claimed to, you know, be
that's
the savior of this animal and that sort of stuff, they get really angry. The reason is, you know, and the metaphor I give is, you know, Superman's best friend is Lex Luthor, because to be a Superman, you need a super villain, you know? And so to be a hero to save the world, to support your ego, you need the villain. So there's a symbiotic relationship there. But, you know, I think there's the movie Batman versus Superman where they're fighting each other.
That's right.
You know, and the reason is they're competing for the same ego, the sense of I'm the hero of this town. And that's where, you know, that's a problem where you end up with most conservation organizations, you know, is that they start subconsciously, they start eating away at meaningful outcomes because,
they're infighting or they're right. Their own egos get in the way, don't they?
Not because they're bad people. That's the human condition.
Right. Right.
You know, and that's, you know, so there's no judgment there. However, and that probably works very well in business, you know, you ruthlessly just, you know, competing for money,
right.
It doesn't work for charity and conservation and meaningful changes in the world we're trying to seek.
Great lessons abound in this conversation. I don't know where you have time to do it, but are you still involved actively in your research and your writing? Is that part of your equation still?
Research, no. I'm writing my fourth book now. So that still continues.
Can you give us a peek at what the fourth book will be about?
They're all sort of autobiographical, you know, about right. my journey and linking into the conservation outcomes and being me, they tend to end up very philosophical about you. Everything. So, so this is I guess the fourth continuation of our journey, and I hopefully taking people on.
I love it, Leif, and I can't wait to link up all of your previous three books for our listeners to consider, because that's what a wonderful way to walk alongside you, right, and learn from your publication as to what your journey has been like. And I guess that's a good way to finish for all the wonderful takeaways. For someone listening now thinking, hey, I want to kind of lead a journey like yours, any final advice for someone getting into the kind of leadership you're doing now?
Mm-hmm. I think the best advice is to, reform yourself, as we talk yourself, before you try to reform the world. And get your act together, and the best skill is the skill to work with others and support others. That's your best skill, because as individuals, humans, we're pretty useless, you know. And you can be the greatest genius in the world, but you'll never succeed if you can't work
by yourself.
Learn the skills and the selflessness to work and support others, and that will be your maximum benefit to achieving meaningful change.
So well put, as you have throughout this conversation, Leif. I'm grateful for that. If I can ask for a parting gift, as you know, I ask every guest to share a book that's been meaningful to them on their journey. So I wonder if there's one you might recommend to our listeners.
Mm-hmm. My favorite book is The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham. It's been made into two movies, one in the 1950s by Tyrone Power.
Oh, wow.
And Bill Murray remade it at The Razor's Edge as well, as a prerequisite for him doing Ghostbusters 2. He loved the story so much.
I did not know that.
That's
wow.
one I'd recommend.
Well, it's fantastic, Leif, and throughout this conversation, and we'll lift that up as well as your own wonderful publications. Where would you like people to go to learn more about the work you're doing?
They can go to theorangutanproject.org, and you can save forest, sponsor an orangutan, or make a donation, tax deductible donation in your area. And even come on one of my eco tours and go into the jungle and see the wonderful heroes on the ground and making that meaningful change that we're supporting.
That sounds exciting. I am delighted to put that into the show notes for this episode. So I hope our listeners will check it out. So for all of this great advice and resources, Leif, thank you for joining me on the path.
Yep, you're most welcome. Thanks, Ben.
Well, I hope you found that conversation as insightful and inspiring as I did. Leif has a wealth of experience and dedication to wildlife conservation, and it offers valuable lessons for leaders like you, regardless of your sector. Now, for more information about Leif and his work, as well as additional resources related to this episode, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode. It's number 254, and you can find them on the podcast page at pmanonprofit.com. And you'll find valuable information to support you on your path to nonprofit leadership, as well as access to all of the podcast episode library that exists there. Now, if you found this episode enlightening, as I hope you did, please share it with somebody else on the nonprofit path. They can benefit from Leif's expertise. Of course, if you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, just go to that same podcast page at pmanonprofit.com and click on the follow button. That will assure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. They come out every Thursday. Thank you again for your dedication to the nonprofit sector and for joining me on this podcast each week. Keep up the great work for causes that matter most to you, and I'll keep bringing you content to help you do it even better. Have a great week. I'll see you next time on The Path.